This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen. David O. Russell's new movie, Silver Linings Playbook, stars Bradley Cooper, who plays Pat Solitano, who's just been released from a mental hospital and is trying to get back with his wife. In this scene at a friend's house, he meets Tiffany, played by Jennifer Lawrence, the sister of the friend's wife. Pat and Tiffany find out they have something in common.
What meds are you on?
Me? None. I used to be on lithium and Seroquel and Abilify, but I don't take them anymore, no. They make me foggy, and they also make me bloated.
Yeah, I was on Xanax and Effexor, but I agree, it wasn't as sharp, so I stopped.
You ever take Klonopin?
Klonopin, yeah.
Right?
Jesus.
Like, is it what?
Yeah.
What day is it? How about Trazodone?
Trazodone?
Well, it flattens you out. I mean, you are done. It takes the light right out of your eye.
God, I bet it does.
The dinner party quickly falls apart, and Tiffany says she wants to leave.
Are you going to walk me home or what?
You mean me?
Yeah, you. Are you going to walk me home?
You have poor social skills. You have a problem.
I have a problem?
Mm-hmm.
You say more inappropriate things than appropriate things. You scare people.
No, I tell the truth, but you're mean.
What, I'm not telling the truth?
Maybe I should drive them home separately?
No. You can drive them both home. No.
Stop talking about me in third
person.
You can take
You me
love
first.
It when I have problems. You love it. You love it, Vaughn, because then you can be the good one. Just say it.
I don't. I just wanted to have a nice...
God.
What is your problem?
Nothing's my problem. I'm fine. I'm tired. I want to go. Come on. Are you ready?
You really, okay. You really want to go right now?
Yes, I really want to go. It's been great.
Okay, guys, the baby is sleeping.
Sorry, I don't want to wake up the baby. Bye.
Sorry, man.
Russell's movie was shot in the Philadelphia area and is the opening film tonight for the Philadelphia Film Festival. It's adapted from the novel Silver Linings Playbook, written by our guest Matthew Quick. He wrote it in his in-laws' basement after quitting his job as a high school English teacher in New Jersey. He's gone on to write three young adult novels, Sorta Like a Rock Star, Boy 21, and a new one, Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock. And Matthew Quick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Are you living that novelist dream, which is to have your very first book turned into a movie?
Yes. I mean, it's quite surreal, but it's a great feeling.
And how were you approached, or how did this book become a movie?
Well, at first I pitched it in New York, and I tried to get a literary agent and
to get it published.
To
right?
get it published, yeah. And a man by the name of Doug Stewart at Sterling Lord Literistic, who's my agent now, fell in love with it. And, you know, after writing in a basement for 3 years, like, that alone was a huge accomplishment. You know, I know writers that have spent 10 years trying to get a literary agent that haven't been able to land one. So that was huge. And I was really excited. And the book sold in Italy at auction. And when that news came in, I was floored. And then I was at a party in Vermont. I was hosting a party. And, of course, if you're a fiction writer and you get a call and you look at your cell phone and it's a New York or L.A. area code, you pick up.
Yes, you do.
You definitely pick up. And so I picked up, and there was a conference call. You know, my literary agent, Doug, was on the phone, and there was Rich Green from CAA. And he says, "I'm your film agent." And I said, "I have a film agent?" Like,
just
I didn't
like
even
that?
Know. Well, Doug had a partnership. But what my agent does is a lot of times when there's good things coming, when he thinks something good might come, he doesn't tell me, because you don't want to get the hopes up until it's a solid thing. And I could hear Doug laughing on the line, like he was so almost giddy, like thrilled. And, you know, they said, we've optioned your film. And they started throwing names at me, like Sidney Pollack, Anthony Minghella, Harvey Weinstein, David O. Russell. And there was a moment, you know, I was upstairs in a bedroom, and all my friends, and I have a party downstairs, and I just couldn't believe it was real. And I got off the phone, and I went into the woods and just was alone for a while before I even told my wife.
Just to kind of digest what had just happened.
To process it. I mean, you know, if you know a fiction writer who's trying to be published and has worked on that for a long time, you realize that that can be quite a lonely journey. And to get to that point where you mm-hmm. see people are respecting your work, it's a beautiful thing.
Well, and I've interviewed novelists who have gotten that far, but that doesn't necessarily become a movie.
Yeah.
And interestingly, you mentioned several of the directors, and David O. Russell directed the adaptation of your novel. He also directed The Fighter, I Heart Huckabees, Three Kings. Was he, when you thought about who could direct this movie version of your novel, was he top on your list? Was he even on your list?
He was top on the list. And, you know, you play that game when you're writing a novel and you talk, you know, to your friends or your wife, like, who would be the character, who would, you know, play the roles, who would direct? And I always said that David O. Russell would be perfect for this film. And there are people on the internet that accuse me of writing it on spec for him.
Really?
Which is completely false, but I take that as a great compliment. I've seen all of his work. He definitely influenced me. And so when that actually happens, it's quite a thing. And when I met David, I told him that, and, you know, I said, you were always the guy. And he said, Rich Greene paid you to say that, you know, as a joking around, but it's definitely true.
And why do you think that is? I mean, I there's certain themes, I think, that he has explored in his movies, ones that you connect with.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, he looks at sometimes the absurdity of life, you know, people in these absurd situations, like in I Heart Huckabees, and trying to do the best job that they can, you know, and getting through it. And, you know, of course, you know, The Fighter is all about family. It's not really a boxing film. It's about this family. It's trying to keep it together and get through this situation. And, you know, I think that's largely what I write about. You know, it's I write character-driven stories, and they often have to do with mental health issues, you know, and David touches on those as well.
And I want to pick up on that, but I mean, as much as it's exciting to think that a David O. Russell would turn your novel into a movie, was it hard to sort of give over the story to someone else? As you said, you had spent 3 years in a basement working on this novel.
Well, the first question I had for Rich Greene, I said, can I write the screenplay? I'd love to write the screenplay. And there's this long pause. And he says, well, maybe, you know, David O. Russell will write the screenplay. And, you know, to hear a name like that attached, I was just thrilled. You know, I was looking forward to see what he would do. And I looked at it and said, you're going to learn so much by, you know, being in the presence of David and seeing what he does with your story, with your source material. And I have. There's a trust issue, you know, and I think that, you know, I'm always telling young writers that when you are in your room alone creating art, you're an artist and you're in control of that world. But when you send your art to New York and LA, you're a professional. And at that point, you need to act professionally. That being said, when David O. Russell was attached, it was a lot easier for me to act professionally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's a very talky movie. And it's interesting to see the movie and then to read your book, because I can see where some of the dialogue is in your novel. Mm-hmm. I can see where the story comes together, where he takes it into a different place.
Sure,
maybe
sure.
Comes back again, but still based around these very memorable and in many ways lovable characters.
Yeah, and you know, David does a lot with improv. You know, he has the actors, you know, do things in many different ways, and then he obviously in the editing they pick the best takes. And it was really interesting to watch him work on set. You know, and I'm someone that needs to go alone in a room and emote, and, you know, no one can knock on the door. I don't want anyone to call me. And to see David work on the fly with 100 people around him, you know, crafting this story. And he was always in command, even though he's trying all of these different things. And then to see the film and see that he's taken it in all these different directions. Mm-hmm. But yet this spirit of what I was trying to do is still so clearly there. And it's so clearly my story. You know, I'm just in awe of how he pulls that off.
In the movie, Pat Solitano is played by Bradley Cooper. In your novel, it's Pat Peoples.
Yes.
This is, and he's telling this story.
Yeah, yeah. In the novel, you're in Pat's head. It's first person. And some of it is told in the form of letters. And so you're very much in Pat's head. And you couldn't do that, I don't think, in a movie, you know, especially with such a great ensemble cast. I mean, it is from Pat's point of view throughout the movie, but I think what David did was, you know, allow more room for people like De Niro to have a larger role.
He plays the dad.
He plays the dad, yep. And even, you know, the character of Ronnie, who John Ortiz plays, you know, it really comes to life and, you know, has a little bit of a bigger role too. And I think he steals a lot of scenes, you know, he's very good.
In the novel, Pat Peoples thinks of life as a movie produced by God. I mean, that's the kind of world that he... a worldview that he has.
Yeah, yeah. And he has this almost delusional philosophy that if he gets physically fit and practices being kind rather than right, that he thinks that God will return his estranged wife to him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, throughout the novel, from the very first page, you realize that that's not going to happen and that he's delusional. But at the same time, at least when I was writing, and a lot of my readers have told me, that you love Pat anyway because he's trying to improve and he's trying to work on his character And in some ways, even though it's this delusional philosophy, it's his form of therapy. It's his form of making order out of chaos. And, you know, I just fell in love with him when I was writing the book.
Well, that's interesting. It also makes him an optimist, yes?
It does, you know, and I think, you know, optimists get a bad rap in our society. You know, oftentimes we think, we associate pessimism with intellect and optimism. You know, we think that that's silly. And, you know, I've been talking a lot, you know, seeing people react to this film and leaving the theater smiling. In my Q&As afterwards, people are just beaming, you know, and I'd like to think it's, you know, my answers to the question. But I think it's really like the story has really influenced them. And I think we need, you know, movies like The Master, which are darker and a little heavier. But we also need the light, too. And we need stories like this that give people a little bit of hope.
It's interesting. You said you fell in love with your character. And I think people that don't write, that might not make any sense because you're obviously making him up, but you're also getting to know him as you write him.
Oh, yeah. You know, your characters become very real. I always say with my first YA book, it was called Sort of Like a Rockstar, the character was Amber.
Young adult.
Young adult, yes. Amber Appleton, I always say she's the daughter I'll never have, you know, and people who write get that, you know, these people are very real. You know, when I'm alone in a room and I'm channeling Pat's voice, I'm creating him, he becomes something very separate from me. You know, he becomes something that's alive, you know, with a mind and a heart and a soul and choices to make.
Was it hard to write this novel? And I know you had written some others, but never, they didn't see the light of day, so to speak. So this was your first one to see the light of day.
Yes. It was definitely not the first one I wrote. And
was it hard to write, though?
It
is hard to write.
Yeah, it's always hard to write. Let's
like
make
it's easy
that clear.
To write, right.
It was hard because the subject matter was very close to my heart. And, you know, I was trying to figure a lot of things out about who I was. And I was in a period of transition in my own life. And, of course, people who read the book is fiction. You know, the characters aren't based on anyone, but it's very easy to pick out, you know, the fact that Pat is in crisis at the beginning. He goes back to live with, you know, his parents, and he has to figure out how to reinvent himself. At the time, I had been in crisis. I was very depressed at the end of my teaching career because I wasn't writing. I quit my teaching career. I was living with my in-laws. I went into a basement. I was trying to figure out who I was as an artist, and that was a very lonely time for me, and it's a very lonely time for Pat in the book. So in many ways, he was a companion, you know, through that journey.
Interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Matthew Quick, and we're talking about a novel that he wrote a number of years ago, the first novel of his that ever got published called Silver Linings Playbook. It's in a new movie called Silver Linings Playbook, starring Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, and it's directed by David O. Russell. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and Matthew Quick is going to read a section from the book, and we open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia opens its season at 3 p.m. Sunday, October 21st at the historic Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul, 17th and Ray Streets on the Parkway. This concert showcases the Bruckner Mass in E minor and the 9/11 anniversary tribute Trinity Requiem by Robert Moran. Featured guests include the Philadelphia Boys Choir and the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Tickets and information online at mcchorus.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. Have you been waiting for the right time to make a pledge to WHYY during this membership campaign? Well, the time is now. A generous donor will give WHYY an additional $1,200 if we hear from 60 listeners today who make a pledge. What a deal. Please call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org and become a member and ensure that we can meet this challenge. Thanks very much.
Widener Law allows the flexibility to schedule classes by offering day, evening, and online courses. Classroom learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, practical skills training, and more. And with a campus located in Delaware, the corporate capital, Widener Law may offer a unique advantage. An information session will be held Saturday, October 20th from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the Delaware campus. Information session details online at law.widener.edu for October 20th. Widener supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Matthew Quick. He wrote a novel a couple of years ago, Silver Linings Playbook, and it has now become a movie of the same name. And he grew up here in the Philadelphia area. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Your main character, Pat Peoples, after he gets out of the mental institution, goes home and lives with his family. He decides to read all the books that his wife was teaching at the high school. And this is a scene I'd love to have you read.
Yeah, so this is in the voice of Pat Peoples, my narrator. When I read the actual story, how Gatsby loves Daisy so much, but can't ever be with her, no matter how hard he tries, I feel like ripping the book in half and calling up Fitzgerald and telling him his book is all wrong, even though I know Fitzgerald is probably deceased, especially when Gatsby is shot dead in his swimming pool. The first time he goes for a swim all summer, Daisy doesn't even go to his funeral. Nick and Jordan part ways, and Daisy ends up sticking with the racist Tom, whose need for sex basically murders an innocent woman. You can tell Fitzgerald never took the time to look up at clouds during sunset, because there's no silver lining at the end of that book, let me tell you. I do see why Nikki likes the novel, as it's written so well. But her liking it makes me worry now that Nikki doesn't really believe in silver linings, because she says The Great Gatsby is the greatest novel ever written by an American, and yet it ends so sadly. One thing's for sure, Nikki is going to be very proud of me when I tell her I finally read her favorite book.
And Nikki is his wife. They are apart. I mean, he has a kind of euphemism for the fact that they're separated.
Yeah, he calls it apart time. And, you know, from the very beginning, especially since it's a first-person narrative, you realize that Pat is a little bit off. And I purposely don't diagnose him at the beginning of the book. And that's very important to me, because I want people to get to know Pat as a person. And I've had readers say, you know, it was frustrating. I wanted to know what was, quote unquote, wrong with Pat. And, you know, my response to that is, you know, maybe nothing's, quote unquote, wrong with him. Get to know him as a person first.
Well, and I'm assuming as a high school English teacher, you probably taught The Great Gatsby.
I did.
And did you have some of the same kind of railings against this novel that your character does?
Yeah. I mean, people will say, why do you hate American literature after reading this book? And I'll say, I love American literature. My character is frustrated. It's a big difference. But when I was teaching at Haddonfield, I worked with many troubled kids as an unofficial counselor. And, you know, I took that very seriously. And one day I received a phone call from a parent. And the parents said to me, why are all of the books you teach on your American literature class, why are they so depressing? You know, my student, you know, goes home every night and has to read these depressing books. And this person was dealing with depression already. It was really bringing them down. And I started to think about that. And I thought, wow, like the message that we send kids through American literature is often very pessimistic. And the only book on my syllabus, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, was the only one that seemed to end on an up note. And I said, why is that? You know, why do all of these books have to be so depressing? And these are books I love, you know, that I've grown up with and I would teach again. But why so much heaviness?
Well, and in fact, at one point, your character says, why does everyone read Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar? Right. Yeah. For the same reason. Right?
A favorite amongst my students, right? You know, like they would, you know, I always taught The Bell Jar because I think it's a really important novel, you know. But my students had a really hard time with it because it's dark and it brings up a lot of issues that many people don't want to think about. Brilliant book. I love that book. But a tough book for teenagers to get through.
But five-year-olds like Hansel and Gretel. And I mean, when you really look at fairy tales, they are cautionary tales and they are frightening stories.
Yes.
And
yes.
We read them to children before we put them to bed.
Yeah, I've read, you know, books on storytelling about that, you know, and I do think that we need the dark, you know. But I think there's light and dark in all of us. And I think sometimes when we tend to concentrate more on one or the other, it can be dangerous. Wow. I think we need balance.
Well, and going back to your character, he believes in these silver linings. I mean, he's always looking up. He believes that things are going to work out for him, although he is a bit delusional about that.
He is. And, you know, if you read the book, you'll see that not everything goes his way, you know. And I think as an author, it's important for me to show that the positive attitude was a vehicle for him to do the work, you know, and the work wasn't always pretty, and not everything that happened in his life was great. But at the same time, you know, especially as a fiction writer, you know, I relied on hope to get me through those dark years. And there were so many people that told me, oh, fiction's dead. The novel's dead. You'll never get an agent. You know, no one's ever going to read you. People are reading Kindles now, not books. There's so much endless, awful stuff that people were telling me to bring me down. I needed to be almost wildly optimistic just to keep writing, to battle all of that. And I think Pat is someone too. He comes home and his parents, you know, their marriage is not good. There's a lot of negativity there. You know, he lives in this neighborhood where people are obsessing about the Eagles and the Eagles are losing. And, you know, he needs something to combat that.
What I also appreciated both in the movie and I have to say in your book as well is the depiction of the therapist. And Pat has a therapist, a Dr. Patel, and he's wise. He seems to understand Pat really well. And oftentimes therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists are depicted like they're these weirdos or these sort of eccentric, offbeat and people that you probably wouldn't go to if you were looking for a really good therapist. This is an exception to that, I think.
You know, and I can't say that was really a conscious choice. You know, I just crafted, you know, maybe somebody that I would like to do therapy with, you know, and but after the book came out, I started to receive emails from psychiatrists and therapists that just said, thank you for like depicting us as normal people.
Right,
you know,
real
that
people.
People that go to Eagles games, that, you know, have lives, that have kids, and, you know, they're not, you know, off on some, you know, academic island. You know, they're real people that are just trying to figure things out and help people out. And I think therapy gets a really, really bad rap sometimes. And, you know, I know people in my family and friends that have benefited greatly from therapy. And I think it's time to take away the stigma a little bit.
It's a personal question. Have you been in therapy? I mean, I've been in therapy. Have you been in therapy?
I have not been in traditional therapy, but untraditionally, yes. One of my mentors is the former CEO of Steininger, which is not called Steininger anymore, but they were the largest mental health provider in the South Jersey area, a guy by the name of Dr. Len Altamora. And he would consider, you know, he would call me a friend, but, you know, we talk regularly and he advises me. And I have many mentors and my wife and I take turns being therapists with each other. And some people say that that's good and not good, but I would say I do a lot of therapy through my art, too.
Well, that's interesting. And your book is dedicated to your wife. It says La Raison,
the reason. And she definitely was the reason. I don't think I would have left teaching unless she forced me to. And, you know, whenever I write a book, Alicia's my first reader, and I give it to her, and I don't ask her if the book is good. I say, is the book authentically me? And she's the only one that can tell me. And I think that she knew when I was teaching, and I was very a popular teacher, very much accepted by the Haddonfield community. She was the one who saw that, you know, I was slowly dying there.
Really?
Because I wasn't practicing my art.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the fact that you were a kind of unofficial counselor for a lot of kids. I mean, do you think there is or was something about you that kids felt they could confide in you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I just think it's my personality. I'm a very empathetic person. You know, sometimes to a fault. You know, sometimes that can be a problem for me, and I tend to pick up on certain things with people. And I think kids are desperate, especially teenagers, and especially in schools where the main focus is to get into a really good university and to appear perfect on your college transcript letters and all of that. They're desperate to talk about their warts. They're desperate to talk about the things that aren't going right, you know, the secrets that we don't like to put out there. And, you know, it's amazing. I think if you go into any high school in America, you will see kids are hurting and they don't have the avenues to talk about a lot of this. And of course, for me, I always said that, you know, literature is the study of the extraordinary, but it's also the study of people, you know, so a lot of this stuff would come up. So you read The Bell Jar and then all of the girls that are having, you know, these issues of being, you know, feeling oppressed by their fathers or their boyfriends or, you know, their cutting or things of that nature. Like, it's a perfect vehicle for them to come and talk to you about these things. And I saw over and over that they were so hungry and so grateful if you just sat down for 20 minutes and listened and didn't say anything, just listen, let them vent. You know, it was so important.
Meaning that they don't have either parents or adults or others in their life that they feel they can vent to, perhaps without being given advice about what to do about their life?
I think that's part of it, you know, and especially in the community that I was in, you know, there's such a rigid, you know, path to college and, you know, what you're supposed to be. And I feel like some of the kids felt as though they had to be perfect all the time. And, you know, in my class, I tried to preach, you don't have to be perfect. You have to be you, you know, and that's a message that kids don't get, you know. And all of my students were being encouraged to go into the sciences because that's where the money is, you know. So I was always saying, you know, why not the arts? You know, you're a great musician, you know, you're a great writer. And that was not a message that they were hearing. They were hearing, you know, it's fun to write and being an artist, but, you know, you need to go and be an engineer or a doctor or whatever. And those are fine professions, and we need all of those people, and that's great. And if that's what you feel called to do, that's a beautiful thing to be a doctor. And some of my students are doctors, and they're very successful. But we don't encourage kids to talk about how they really feel and what they're really called to do.
And that's Matthew Quick, our guest today on Radio Times. His novel, Silver Linings Playbook, is now a movie of the same name. He spent a number of years teaching high school English in New Jersey. He has also written three young adult novels, Sort of Like a Rockstar, Boy 21, and a new one, Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we get to the calls, though, but here you are talking to students as a high school teacher and perhaps an unhappy high school teacher saying, you know, follow your passion. What are the things that you really care about? And yet you were in a job, at least for a while, that really wasn't your passion.
Yeah, the principal that hired me at Haddonfield is a man by the name of Dr. Joe Sirico, who I admired tremendously. And he got what I did in my classroom. He got what I did counseling kids. And he was very appreciative of that. And when I left Haddonfield, when I told him I was leaving, he said, you know, I'm sad to see you go. He said, but, you know, you've been telling kids to, you know, follow their bliss for 6 years. Now you're going to show them. And at the time, I felt an incredible sense of responsibility because I didn't know if I could do it, right? You know, I didn't know if I was going to be able to publish. But I've kind of carried that with me. And my former students, you know, some of them have been listening to the interviews that I'm doing today and have, you know, written things on Facebook. And I'd like to think that, you know, it's an extension of my classroom. Like, what I'm doing right now is also saying to my students, like, listen, like, I told you, follow your bliss, like, be who you are. This is me, you know, this is me being authentically me. This is the healthiest I can be mentally doing this. And you should try to find what works for you, too.
Have you gone back to your school to talk to the students that are there now?
I haven't been back to Haddonfield High School, but I've been to Collingswood High School, which is where I graduated several times. And I go to a lot of high schools and universities and talk. And it's amazing when I talk about this stuff. I could be, you know, I was at Drexel a couple of years ago. There was 800 people in the auditorium. And I'm talking about this stuff. And I could pick out every kid in the audience that wants to be a writer or an artist because their eyes just light up. And they don't get this message. And when you go in and you tell young people, like, yes, it's okay to be an artist and express yourself and do the things that you really want to do. And it's even possible to make your living. I've had kids like on the verge of tears, you know, like, thank you for saying that this is okay. Like, I've been told my whole life, you know, I have to be a doctor or I have to be whatever. And I think that, you know, for a lot of kids, it's a process of coming out in a certain way, you know, like saying this is who I am. And that might clash with who you want me to be. And for me, that was very much my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Richard from Haddonfield joining us on Radio Times. And Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations to Matt. Matt, this is Rich, used to work at Haddonfield. We used to play basketball together.
We knew this was going to happen. Go ahead,
brief.
Rich. Okay.
The last time I saw you at the Collingswood Book Fair, and we were the Silver Linings Playbook I had read, and you had said that, you know, I guess maybe your agent or whatever was encouraging you into the young adults because they felt that was your niche because of the teacher. Now that you've had the real kind of success here, where's your passion? Where are you going from here? Are you going to stick with the YA, or are you going to try to concentrate on adult novels?
Rich, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Matthew.
Well, in the last year and a half, I actually wrote two books. One of them is called Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock, which is a young adult book that comes out next August. And I've also written an adult book that I can't talk about yet because it's not under contract. So I'm doing both. But to answer the question in a different way, When I first started writing YA, my agent asked me, he said, you should write YA, you know, teenagers. And I said to him, you know, that's not what I do. You know, I write adult books. And he said, listen, don't overthink it. It's not a genre question. Do exactly what you do. Just set it from the point of view of a teenager. Don't change anything else. And that was really freeing. And so when I sit down to write a book from the point of view of a teenager, I don't do anything differently. I just write the story and try to get into that character's head. So, you know, I just try to do what I do all the time.
Well, I have to say, Pat, in Silver Linings Playbook, he's a teenager at heart. I mean, there is something adolescent about him, in a good, not in a bad sense, in a good sense.
Yeah, and I think for two reasons. He you know, without giving any spoilers, he's kind of knocked back, you know, into a childlike state, which I find quite beautiful. But also, he's starting again. Like, you know, like what does it mean to be adult? Like, you're out on your own. You have your own house, you have a job, you have adult responsibility. Well, he gets rid of all that and he goes back to his parents. So, you know, literally and metaphorically, like, he returns to this season of childhood to start over.
Is there, and I hear what you're saying about young adult fiction, that it's not a category by itself, but do you think it doesn't get the kind of respect that it deserves from the larger literary community, whatever that is?
Yeah, there's a lot of great realistic YA fiction out there. And, you know, people tend to think, well, you're writing it YA, you must be writing about wizards and vampires. And, like, there's great books about wizards and vampires, too, and they often get demonized unfairly. But I think, you know, it's just a marketing term. That's all it is. And, you know, you hear things, you know, I've heard snobby people say, like, oh, you're writing young adult, you're playing for the JV team or whatever. And I just, you know, I don't pay attention to any of that. Like, I'm a storyteller, and the people that appreciate my stories, they're not thinking about marketing. They just want a good story. They want something that makes them feel, and, you know, something to think about, and that's what I try to offer them.
But do you think that readers, that younger readers respond to fiction differently, or even to the writer differently? Do you hear, for instance, from younger readers, you might not hear from adults?
I hear from both, actually. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I hear from a lot of adults that read my young adult books, and I hear from teenagers that love the Silver Linings Playbook. Right. And I try not to get hung up on all that. Like, I know that it's important, you know, for people who sell the books, and, you know, it's important to package, and all those things are, you know, part of being professional. But when I go in to make art, you know, when I go into my room and write, I don't think about any of that. And, you know, I'm just glad that I'm able to make my living, that people are reading my work.
We're almost up at a break here, but when you go into your room to make art, are you sitting at a typewriter? Are you pacing? Are you, you know, running around doing laundry in between, you know, paragraphs?
Well, my wife will tell you that I'm never not writing, because, you know, I literally write at a table with, I have a MacBook Pro that I work on. But, you know, when I'm hiking a mountain with my wife, I'm thinking about, and even now, like, I'm thinking about stories, and, you know, every experience I have, like, every bit of language that I hear, you don't turn it off. And that's both a good and a bad thing. You know, people always say, like, how do you have the discipline to sit down and write? And for me, it's, my wife would say, you should do less of that. You should take more time off.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Matthew Quick. We're talking about writing. He has written, looks like, four novels now, Sort of Like a Rock Star, Boy 21, Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock, coming out later, and his first one, Silver Linings Playbook, now a movie. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Have you been waiting for the right time to make a pledge to WHYY during this membership campaign? Well, the time is now. A generous donor will give WHYY an additional $1,200 if we hear from 60 listeners today who make a pledge. What a deal. Please call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org and become a member and ensure that we can meet this challenge. Thanks very much.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. How's this for a fantasy come true? You quit your job teaching high school English. You spend several years writing a novel in your in-law's basement. It gets published. It receives positive reviews. And then it's turned into a movie starring Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, directed by David O. Russell. And that actually happened to our guest, Matthew Quick, author of Silver Linings Playbook. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Lisa from Winona, New Jersey to join us. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Quick. I just wanted to thank you for writing your novel. You seem to have an understanding of mental health. I'm a therapist in Burlington County. And in the beginning of the book where you said you didn't diagnose your character, I think when people have a diagnosis attached to them, they become one-dimensional rather than knowing the whole person, which makes them a three-dimensional person. And then all the other things that go along with the diagnosis, that's the little box you put them in. So I just wanted to thank you that and for painting a positive picture of therapists.
Lisa, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Matthew, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, thanks. I couldn't agree more, and it means a lot to me to hear that. And, you know, it's very frustrating to see, you know, depictions, especially in the media, of people, you know, sometimes even demonized, but definitely pigeonholed, you know, by, you know, a label, you know, be it a mental health label or any other label. And, you know, as a fiction writer, I think one of the most important things you can do is promote understanding. You know, I feel like that's my job, to like let people understand my characters. And you don't get a lot of understanding from a label or a diagnosis.
Lisa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Interestingly, though, you spent a year teaching at the Bancroft School, which deals with children, I guess, with learning disabilities and autism.
Yeah, I worked for a year during the day. I worked with teenagers diagnosed with severe autism. It was a classroom, and we did behavior therapy. And at night, I would pick up extra shifts at the Lindens, which was largely for brain trauma, and you know, it was a neural health facility. So people would call it a lockdown facility. It's not a very popular term, but no. There were people that needed 24-hour care.
And what did you learn? I mean, did that help you as a writer? Obviously, you have this feeling that you have for other people.
You know, I got the job because I came out of college and there wasn't a lot of jobs out there. And I met the mother of a friend of mine who worked there and said, "What are you doing?" I met her at the mall. So, you know, I was roofing at the time. I was a roofer. And she said, "That's no good. You should work. You know, come and get some experience. You know, you can get some special ed experience. It would be good for you later for the resume." And that's why I went. But when I got there, I realized that and very quickly that I was probably going to learn more in a couple months, and I learned 4 years as an education major.
Really?
Not only about, you know, what it's like to be a teacher, but how to be patient and how to get inside of people's heads that view the world very differently than you do, and have experienced the world, you know, differently than you do, and, you know, to see them as people. And I really did, you know, and it was so interesting. You know, to take a group of teenagers diagnosed with autism to, say, Pizza Hut, you know, and you walk in and you see the stairs and you feel that. And when you're with these kids, they're your kids. Like, I love these kids. They're my students. And I remember getting angry, you know, at people looking at us. And, you know, in retrospect, I realized they just didn't understand. They had no understanding of this. But to have that experience and to feel the stigma firsthand really, really bothered me.
Do you miss teaching? And I ask you that because when you talk about your students, whether at high school in New Jersey or at Bancroft, I mean, you talk with a great deal of passion and empathy for these young people.
I miss teaching, and I feel very guilty about not teaching.
Do you really?
My last thing I did at Haddonfield chaperoned a trip to South America, and I remember being in a hotel room. I think it was in Lima, Peru, and an episode of Boston Legal came on, and it was like this like heartwarming episode where the teacher makes a difference in the kids' lives. And I remember like crying and saying, I made a mistake. Like, I can't leave teaching. And, you know, like, it really took a lot of courage for me to let go. And I remember when we got back to Haddonfield on the bus, my students had put together a notebook, and they had all written me a letter, you know, encouraging me to write and thanking me for what I did. And it was so hard that when they gave it to me, I walked away and didn't even talk to any of the parents because I was so emotional. I just couldn't be there anymore, and I just had to walk away. And so it's very hard. And I go back into schools now, and, you know, people will compliment me after I speak, and they'll say, it's such a shame you're not in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I feel so guilty about that. But at the same time, you know, I feel as though with the writing, you can reach a much larger audience, and hopefully I can put good into the world that way.
But it's interesting, your students knew that you needed to write, right? They, maybe you had told them, or they understood that you needed to write.
Yeah, I think a lot of my students, you know, they had that sense of, you know, here's this guy that's so passionate about writing and literature, and he's always telling us to, you know, go into the arts. Is, I think if I had stayed, they would have been disappointed. You know, I think they would have said, you know, hypocrite or whatever. You know, you can only talk that way for so long before you make a big jump yourself. And I really do view the time that I taught teaching American literature and writing as almost a class. I was learning myself, you know, and the best way to learn is to teach, I think. And, you know, I was listening to myself say all this, these things, and give all these messages. And at some point I had to, you know, take my own advice.
Your new book, not out quite yet, but called Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock. And I only know a little bit about what I read about it, about an 18-year-old boy goes to school on his birthday with murder and suicide on his mind.
Yeah, he takes his grandfather's war trophy from World War II. It's a Walther P-38 Nazi issued. And it's set in a 24-hour period, and you're in Leonard's head, and you go through his decision-making process through the day. And tonally, it's very different than what I've written before. Thematically, it's very consistent. And I'm really excited about this book. And one of the reasons why I wrote it is, you know, violence and shootings and school violence is on everybody's mind. And I think sometimes when we hear about this, our reaction is to say, you know, who's to blame? And the thing that frustrates me as a former teacher is that we don't pay attention to what's going right in schools every day, and why there aren't more of these things happening. So I really wanted to put the emphasis on who are these people in Leonard's lives that might be making a difference.
Well, and I also read that you had consulted with a therapist or a social worker, or maybe
several,
both.
Several, yeah.
Just because you don't want a copycat book. I mean, I haven't read the book, so I don't know how it all ends, but it sounds like you were very careful about constructing this character.
I was. And, you know, I the book was completely finished by the time I had it vetted, you know, and I sent it to Dr. Len Altamora, my mentor, you know, first, because I trust him. And he's been a fan. He's read all of my work, and he gets me. He knows the authentic cue. And then he reached out to several psychiatrists and therapists and social workers, and they read the book, and we had a fantastic response. And right. It was just like little tweaks, like suggestions about behavior, you know, that they kind of filled me in on. I wanted to make sure it was authentic. So if a teenager who is having these feelings or was going through anything, they found it an authentic rendering of this.
And that's Matthew Quick, our guest today on Radio Times. He's written three young adult novels, as they're called, sort of like A Rock Star, Boy 21, and Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock. And he's also the author of a novel, Silver Linings Playbook, which is now a movie. I'm Artie Moscowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, I really have neglected to talk about the fact that the Eagles figure so prominently in your novel. Clearly, you're an Eagles fan. I don't know if you live in Massachusetts now, so I don't know if that has hung on to you as you moved out of the area.
Here's how big of an Eagles fan I am. I'm still a season ticket holder, and I drive 5 hours each way just to see the Birds play when they're home, and I never miss a game.
Wow. So did you grow up? I mean, did you grow up in one of those families that's just obsessed with the Eagles or Philly sports teams?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the people in my family are very typical Philadelphia sports fans, you know, very passionate, a lot of gloom and doom, you know. And so we did grow up on that. And, you know, I grew up in Oakland, which is a blue-collar town. And, you know, the men in the town weren't, you know, the type of guys that, you know, are hugging their sons or telling them they love them. You know, my father, he took me to the Eagles game. Like, that was what we did together, you know. And even now, it's a vehicle for us to talk about things, you know, metaphorically. You know, when I
so you
when
talk
I,
about players as a, instead of maybe talking about your, you know, your feelings or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like, for example, like, when I was in Logan the other day, just 2 days ago, and I was going to Dallas and have this big publicity tour, my father called me up on the phone, and, you know, he didn't say, you know, I'm really excited for you, like, I'm really proud of you. He said, you know, the Eagles fired their defensive coordinator, you know, and we talked about that. And you know, in a way, like, I realized that's my dad, you know, that's the language that we've always used. That's the language that his father used. My grandfather grew up in Philly during the Great Depression, you know, was very poor growing up, a really big fan of the Philadelphia A's, you know, and, you know, my grandfather, you know, World War II vet, not a guy that talks about his feelings a lot. He's not with us any longer, but, you know, sports was something that we talked about, and I called my grandfather every Sunday night, you know, for 20 years, and we would talk about the Birds, and we would talk about the Phillies, and that's what we had. You know, we had a deep respect and love for each other, too, but these men that are in my lives, they don't have the vocabulary that I have. They're not the empathetic person that I am. And so this is a way for me to communicate with them. And I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Robert De Niro plays the father in the film adaptation of your novel. And there's a lot of, you know, superstitious behavior. If you hold, you know, hold a rag, I guess an Eagles rag in a certain kind of way, that's going to be good luck. If you're sitting in a special chair, did you grow up with that, those superstitious behaviors?
Yeah, I don't really remember my father, you know, being very superstitious. But my brother and I, you know, definitely have rituals.
Do you?
You know, and the guys I tailgate with, you know, there's definitely things that we do. Like, my brother wears a Jerome Brown jersey, you know, every game. I wear a Mike Quick jersey every game. When the Eagles, you know, score a touchdown, my brother will stand on the railing, and then he will tackle us. You know, it's just a ritual that we have. And I don't know so much if it's OCD behavior or, you know, superstition. It's just something that's familiar for us to do. And De Niro's character in the movie, obviously, you know, is displaying some obsessive compulsive, you know, behavior. But I think it's something that a lot of people can relate to. You know, I think we all have that magical thinking with us sometimes, you know.
Well, you can see that with athletes as well. I mean, there's certain rituals that they will do on the field just to either get them in a certain kind of zone or even maybe their own good luck.
Yeah, and
gestures.
I think, you know, this is a little bit different with a fan because, you know, we're really not, well, I shouldn't say this as a fan because I'll get killed.
Go ahead.
You know, we're really not affecting the play on the field, right? You know, whereas an athlete, you know, they're doing things to get in the right mind frame because they are, you know, and as a writer, I have rituals and I need to be alone in a room and I don't like to have guests in the house when I'm writing. And you know, I have a picture of my grandfather and my grandmother and my grandfather's dog tags. And, like, I like to have those things around me. But it's more for, you know, an emotional response that it helps me emote more than the, you know, superstitious stuff.
The mom in this novel, you know, makes the snacks for the game, the
Krabby snacks.
Krabby snacks. Yeah. Sounds kind of tasty and really bad for you.
Yeah, they correct on both counts. My mother does make Krabby snacks, and they're quite delicious.
And what are the ingredients, you know?
It's basically a English muffin, crab meat, and then some cheese melted on it, and probably a lot of butter.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Let me get, looks like Jim from Avalon to join us. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Marty, I just wanted to say something real quick.
Sure.
I'm 80 years old. I wish 70 years ago someone like Matthew had said to me, follow your dream and so forth. I also think Matthew sounds like a kid that has his hand in the cookie jar and everyone's happy for him.
That's really
how
nice.
He sounds.
Well, that's
and
really nice.
Thing,
no, go ahead.
And the last thing I have to say is quickly is that what he's doing, you know, giving up the teaching, but what he's doing with his speaking engagements and his writing is touching people that he doesn't even know. And I'm glad to know you. I'm just glad to know. I never heard of you, and I just am glad to know about you. And I will get on my computer and Google you and find out what I can about you. Thank you so much.
Well, Jim, bye-bye, and thank you, Jim, for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead, Jim, Matthew.
Thank you so much for that. You know, and it's a beautiful to hear. And you know, I do feel a great deal of responsibility for everything, you know, that I've been given the opportunity, and, you know, the books that I put into the world, I think about them, and, you know, I hope, you know, that they do make people's lives easier. You know, that's one of the things that is my goal. It's a primary goal of mine, because I know for me, story has saved me a million times. Going to the movies has saved me. Reading novels has saved me. I always say art saves. The writing saves me too, but, you know, other people's stories have affected me. And I often think about all of the novels and movies that I've seen. I've never contacted the creator. All of the music I've listened to, I've never contacted the creator. So it's great to be reminded that my voice and my words are affecting people. So thank you.
Are you surprised how your life has turned out? I don't know. Did you have a game plan?
You know,
it's a sports metaphor.
There's a part of me that kind of always knew that I wanted to do this. And I had a mentor at LaSalle University, a woman by the name of Helena White, who was my drama teacher. And I remember, like, talking with her all the time, and she encouraged me to write plays, and I would write these, you know, ridiculously long plays, and she would read them and give me feedback. And I was speaking with her about a year ago, and I said, why did you pick me, you know, to encourage to write? Like, I wasn't, you know, a top student. I wasn't really, you know, a great writer at the time. And she said, because when you talked about writing, I believed you were going to do it.
Wow.
And, you know, I think that's a part of it.
Well, Matthew Quick, it's been a great pleasure, and I congratulate you as well on all your work. Thanks so much for joining us today, Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Matthew Quick's book is called Silver Linings Playbook, and it has been adapted into a movie. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Assistance today from Jared Broud. And thank you so much for joining us.